Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And we are so glad that you are here with us tonight. I'm coming to you live from Eastern Kentucky tonight, not deep beneath the earth, but a local hotel in Eastern Kentucky. We're glad that you're here with us. It's May 10th, 2009. On February 10th, 2009, Iridium 33 collided with Cosmos 2251 over northern Siberia, and the two satellites were shattered. U.S. Strategic Command has since cataloged 981 pieces of debris, 25 of which have already entered Earth's atmosphere. By my count, that's about 956 pieces of those satellites that are still up there and could come down at any time. Of course, some of them are small enough to burn up in the atmosphere, and some, I fear, may not. So if you go out in your backyard and you find something really strange with what looks like Russian writing on it, give us a call. Don't call the government first. Call X Squared Radio, and we'll send someone out to pick that thing up, and we'll see if we can see what's on it. The solar wind tonight, 420.7 kilometers per second. On May 9th, which was yesterday, 1614 Greenwich Mean Time, the sun emitted a strong shortwave radio burst. That's right. The loud swishing sound you just heard, if you go to spaceweather.com, you can click on it and listen to it, is a combo Type 3, Type 5 solar radio burst caused by electron beams moving through the sun's outer atmosphere. The source of the electrons is probably an active region now emerging over the sun's eastern limb, sunrise on the sun. Or should I say Earthrise on the sun? The unnumbered region is crackling with low-level A and B-class solar flares and could produce more radio sounds in the days ahead. Ham radio operators, point your Yagis toward the sun. Now, what we don't know is what these bursts are doing to the biological transducer called the human body. Interesting that the sun is sending out messages in the form of radio bursts. They make their way here. And Wisconsin police can attach GPS to your car to secretly track your movements without obtaining search warrants, an appeals court ruled Thursday. That means police are seemingly free to secretly track anyone's public movements with a GPS device, the three-judge panel wrote. So make sure to take the batteries out of your phone and make sure to stop off at Radio Shack and get yourself a GPS device scanner for your car if you think you might have a reason to be followed. Last week on X Squared Radio, we had the incredible Michael Cremo on board. He spoke of the antiquity of the modern human being. Would you believe we go back as far as 55 million years, maybe further? Could be older than 500 million years if the stitched sole footprint next to the dinosaur print in the same mud mean anything. Now, if you have children in college and you are buying lots of textbooks and they cost lots of money until now, you need to check out Campus Book Rentals and discover the newest and least expensive way to get those textbooks. You rent them. That's amazing, isn't it? I think it is a fantastic way to make a great college education available to everyone. So you need to click on the Campus Book Rentals banner at xsquaredradio.com and see if you can't lower the price of those textbooks for yourself if you're a college student, and for your college student if you are the lucky benefactor or parent paying the way of one through college. Now, we often talk about preparedness here at X Squared Radio. That's why we have NitroPack as one of our favorite affiliates. They have everything from 72-hour kits to full food storage packages. Don't get stuck with a 55-gallon drum of wheat. Sounds good, but you can't haul it anywhere if you have to move. You still have time to plan. So make survival the least of your worries by visiting NitroPack today. Click on the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and start small. Start with something, anything. I know you're not doing it because I went to our affiliate and checked. And yes, several thousand of you have clicked on the banner, but nobody has purchased anything. That either means you're going to Walmart and buying your food storage supplies, your emergency preparedness supplies, or you're not prepared. And that is just simply not acceptable on this radio program. We are about awareness. We are about preparedness. And we are about bringing the past to the future and mixing science and spirituality together so that you have the information you need to prepare. Now, I get lots of emails from listeners who say, what shall I do to get ready for the times that are coming, for the 2012 end times, for the possible cataclysms, for the possible loss of my job, or for other economic catastrophes that might befall us? Here in eastern Kentucky and western Kentucky, in the last few weeks, they have been bothered by ice storms. No small amount of ice either. I mean, tons and tons of it snapping off trees, breaking power lines. And that's not the least of it. Companies come from as far south as Louisiana up here to Kentucky to cut up limbs, chip them up and haul them off to landfills. And you would think a few days without electricity is bad enough, but there are economic impacts to having 2 or 3 weeks of lost business. For some, it is the straw that breaks the camel's back. One Chevrolet dealership in Madisonville, Kentucky, around for many decades, bankrupt. Gone, out of business, all the cars hauled away. Ice storm was the straw that broke the camel's back. Hopkinsville Mall used to be a thriving economic place to go shopping there in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. A ghost mall now. Only the anchors are there, and of course, the occasional mall walker. Where do the people go that used to work in those stores? That's right. They try to go to the fridge and there isn't anything there. They probably weren't listening to X Squared Radio. And if they were listening to X Squared Radio, they didn't click on the NitroPack banner and get prepared. You've got time. You've got a little bit of money. Let's get to it. Phone lines will be open all night tonight. We are trying to get a reschedule of Danny and Brinkley on the program. He was scheduled to come on April 26th, was unavoidably detained. Today is Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day, all you out there who are mothers or who are thinking about becoming mothers. It is one of those jobs that doesn't go away and from which you cannot be downsized. But I hear the pay is terrible. Long hours, lots of investment, and you have no idea if you're going to see a return on it or not. Some kids never grow up and stay kids their whole life and thus a burden on their parents. That's not to say it's not great to be childlike. It is. I am as well. But to be childish is different than being childlike. So the phone lines tonight, toll free anywhere in the world, 888-228-4494. And if you've got free nights and weekends, like most Americans that pack a cell phone in their pocket, you can reach us at 530-776-5154 or 5185. 530-776-5154. And we also take calls on Skype at BBS Radio and at PalTalk at BBSRadio_com. So we take calls that way as well. While we are trying to get Danny on the phone, either this hour or the next, I wanted to bring up the subject of swine flu. We made a little light of it last week, that pigs flu, or swine flu, not to make light of anyone's hardship. More than 170 deaths from it so far. And unless you watch the news or pay attention to Center for Disease Control news, you wouldn't know that May is not typically flu season. October is flu season. So to have a flu flare up like this one and be isolated and documented as containing human DNA is rather alarming. Not that we want to be alarming to you, but this one has peculiar properties to it. Seems it preys on the immune system. The stronger the immune system, the stronger the flu. That's a little bit different. Usually when your immune system is run down and the flu gets you is when the flu gets you. But this one progresses into pneumonia so fast because of the immune system of the human body working overtime with a histamine reaction. So there is a cure out there. There is a vaccine, but it is not mass-produced yet. Very similar to a flu that came through turn of the century-ish and wiped out 50% of some cities. So watch out for the rebound in October. Again, it would be a good idea to just practice good hygiene. And we would also like to know, and this is not a political program, but we have socioeconomic effects, and those effects pour over into the spiritual as well from the banking bailout. I would like to know if you have had an experience where a bank has made it hard on you to make ends meet. That is to say, you might own commercial property and the bank that you deal with went broke. And when it went broke, your notes got called due and you're not out of business because the bank is out of business. Or you have a home mortgage with the bank and you are a little behind and the bank was working with you, and then the bank got itself in trouble, and that kind of paper becomes premium paper for selling at a discount. And perhaps a new collection is forced upon you. Commercial or residential banks have played their role in building nations, but they've also, it seems of late, played their role in destroying nations. And maybe that's where your community is right now. So if you see that the nicest building in town is the bank, and everyone else has their doors closed, why don't you give us a call? We'll talk about it a little bit. We also want to talk about photons from space. Now, you might think that sounds like a Twilight program, but it is not. Photons are information that come to us from space. We can tell all kinds of things about stars and sources of light in the sky coming to Earth by the photon itself. It carries information for us. For instance, we can tell if a star is spinning or not, spinning quickly or spinning slowly, by the photon. We can tell if the star is moving toward us or moving away from us. We can also tell what is the metallic content of that star, even the organic content, if there is one, of that star by the photon that gets to us. Now, we get to see that photon by some detector, by some spectrophotometer. But the human body experiences photons in a little different manner. Let's talk about the photons that strike the skin. If we receive photons in the right wavelength, that is, a shorter wavelength, like ultraviolet, it has a tendency to burn our skin. The skin cells die and flake off. Sometimes, if the skin is burned severely enough, it will peel off in sheets, and other times it just kind of comes off as a white powder. Billions of dead cells killed by excess ultraviolet radiation. Infrared, a much longer wavelength, about 1,000 nanometers in length, has a different effect. It warms us, makes us sweat. And other photons of different frequencies, very short frequencies down in the X-ray, and even longer in the radio area, or very long wave energy in the ELF, which is extremely low frequency, and then there's ultra-low frequency, and then there's super-low frequency. And it is also known clinically that these frequencies have an effect on the human transducer, that is, our physical body. For instance, very early in the space program, when astronauts left the sound bowl of the Earth and made their way into space where it's quiet, no vibration, the very first astronauts experienced great anxiety and fatigue, which took days to recover from, because they were not receiving the vibration, the frequency from the Earth. Some say 7.8 hertz, some say 14.8 hertz, and there are harmonics of that as well. Now, this can be very high amplitude, which means it can be felt or sensed somehow, or very low amplitude, that is, very quiet, very soft. Nevertheless, the right frequency seems to resonate with something in the human body. Without it, great anxiety, depression, disconnection. It would imply that there is some kind of link, like a Wi-Fi network between the human transducer, human body, and planet Earth. As if that isn't surprising enough, as that frequency changes of the Earth, so changes the human body. Just to give you a few examples, during a full moon, or shortly thereafter, there are remarkable and significant, statistically significant changes in average behavior. And it only occurs during a full moon. There are frequencies that come in from space, not necessarily the sun. I'll give you an example. We had a X-class flare that occurred in the not-too-distant past that did not come from our sun. The X-class radiation that struck the Earth came from another star deep in space. The origin was never exactly pinpointed. A region was identified, but never exactly pinpointed. But the fact that the Earth responded with an aurora borealis and a geomagnetic storm, and the human transducer, we don't know what the behavioral effect was because it didn't happen again. Single events are called outliers in statistics, but when we get two or three of them, then they're called a population, and we can sort of do a scatter plot. In other words, every single time this happens, that happens. There is a direct relationship between the two. So far, no studies have turned up a direct relationship. But the idea that the human body responds in some harmonic, in some sort of harmony with this extremely low frequency of the Earth vibration, it makes sense that it would also change or alter or respond to stimulus in other frequency ranges. So as the solar system moves through the precession and gets closer to this region, which we call the dark rift in the Milky Way, which many scientists believe is a supermassive spinning black hole on its side, and we view it crossways, like looking at the edge of a dinner plate. As we near alignment with that, that gravitational ripple, as far as an embed, we call that a ripple in space-time, sort of like dropping a pebble into a pond and watching the ripples go out from the point of impact. Space, it appears, does that as well. So while space is rippling, it means that light or photons or energy traveling straight through space-time relative to us is not traveling straight at all, but following an undulating fabric of space-time. Straight is moving along the thread that follows the ripple in space-time. It looks like a straight line, but it isn't a straight line relative to us. So as that vibration comes through our space and it comes through our bodies, it is having an effect on us. What is that effect? That's a very good question. The effect would be, if we were to think about it on a physics standpoint, it would be on a molecular level. And let's just talk about molecular biology just for a second. You realize, yes, you are cells, specialized cells working in cooperation with each other, skin cells keeping your body waterproof and containing all of your insides, calcium and bone cells working to support and connect to muscles that allow you to move, various specialized organs like your kidneys and your heart and your spleen and your lungs, and of course your brain, all working in cooperation with one another, usually, to create a total being with awareness, with cognizance, with consciousness. We become, our physical bodies become sort of a vessel in which our consciousness resides. Now, the interesting thing about the human experience is we come into this world as, well, that's a good question, too. Do we come into the world as a fetus? Do we come into the world as a zygote? My feelings on it, and you can discuss it with me if you like, by calling in toll-free 888-228-4494 or anywhere else on planet or off planet at 530-776-5154, or if you're using Skype, simply BBS Radio. And Pal Talk, BBS Radio _com. My feelings are that the spirit, the animated part, the personality part of you is much older than you can imagine, certainly far older than this planet, all of the matter on it, or any of the peas and carrots that make up your human body. And so, in that age, it seeks a vessel in which to become physical and thus experience three dimensions through nerves, which make up this biological transducer. That being said, while that zygote and then fetus is developing in the mother's womb, it would seem that the spirit goes in and out, sort of testing it out, sort of coming in and going out, half here, half there, in between two dimensions, so to speak, experiencing the amniotic dullness of being in the womb, and also being a very wise, very old, very experienced soul. However, once you spew the last of the amniotic fluid from your lungs and you become an air breather, it would seem, at least, the consciousness is somewhat locked into the fetal form. And so, for the next few years, for some it is 3 or 4, for some it's 53 or 54, for most of it's around age 9, a unique phenomenon occurs. We gain enough mastery of whatever language it is we speak that we can now communicate by vibrating muscles in our throat in a certain way and shaping our mouths, tongue, and teeth to form words, and thus we convert the thoughts and the pictures we have in our minds into symbols which are vibrated across air molecules to other beings who hear those vibrations through their ears and convert that into a meaningful message. Vastly slowing down the ability of the mind to communicate, and vastly truncating, especially for 9-year-olds, the ability to express oneself. However, you have now realized, now you've been truncated for 9 Earth years. And so the skills that you once knew of how to communicate telepathically, the memories of worlds and lifetimes and loves and other children that you had and parents through whom you were born in the past is now so distant that you cannot recall it very easily. And if you could, as a 9-year-old, you can't explain it very well to a now completely rational and 3-dimensional society. So, now you get the picture. You are this amazingly animated being in a physical body with your communications truncated down to the speed of the mouth, which is pretty darn slow. It's sort of like hunting and pecking with an index finger trying to write a screenplay. Painfully slow. And once you get one thought out, you forget where you were going in the first place because it took so long to type out the message one letter at a time. Same thing with the human mind. You're slowing your thoughts down to the speed of speech, coordinating muscular movements of your face and throat and lungs and tongue to make words to go out over the airwaves to speak to other people who might listen. But your mind is racing thousands of times faster than that. And if it were possible to broadcast what it is you're really thinking at the speed with which you are thinking it, pictures and colors and textures and emotions, can you imagine thinking an emotion to someone else and having them get it at the speed with which you want to send it and understand it? I know it can't be done. Not in this body. Occasionally it can be done. A fleeting moment, you get a thought you can read of someone else's, but it doesn't really mean that you can hear or they can hear everything that you're saying or everything that they're saying. So now the human transducer and the soul that's inside of it are nearing this point in space of photons from space. And they are singing a new message, not just the radio pulse that came from the sun yesterday, which if you go to spaceweather.com, you can listen to it for yourself. And that's, by the way, radio converted to audio so that you can hear it. Because you can't hear radio waves. The wavelength is too short. How is it affecting your body? How is it affecting the dormant genes that make up the mitochondria and the cells in every single human body? Now, some would say that your genes are who you are. Not true. It's been disproven, and we could go over it if you like. If you want to call in, we'll discuss it. You are a product of your environment. How you walk, what you eat, how you smile, how you interact with others, where you live, your sleeping habits, your thinking habits. All of this make up your environment. And your environment also includes your consciousness. So your environment begins to change, that is to reprogram the cells that make up your body. Let me get even more specific than that. They reprogram the molecules that make up the cell walls of your cells. Your cell walls look almost like the silicon chips that we make our integrated circuits from. And the cell wall can be programmed just like an EEPROM, just like those little EEPROM chips in your TomTom, in your PlayStation, in your Xbox. The EEPROMs that are in there that run those programs are very similar in molecular makeup, gates and channels, just like the cell walls of the human cells. And so they become programmed. Now, that doesn't mean that just because they are a hard drive that they do thinking, that they're intelligent. They are not. They only run the program that has been programmed into the cell wall. If you reached into your cells and yanked the nucleus out of your cells, the cell not only would not die instantly, it would continue to respirate. It would continue to consume food, expel waste, and defend itself against toxins until it grew old, in which case it would die. The only thing it would not be able to do is reproduce. It would be able to do everything else. Everything else. So your body is running an automatic at about 25,000 times the speed of conscious thought. It can't slow down to conscious thought, and you cannot accelerate your conscious thought to be in sync with your subconscious. It's not possible. The speed differences are too great. What you can do, however, is you can reprogram the hard drive. You can run a new program inside of your body. You can store new information in the walls of your own cells. And that, my friends, is what makes you, you. It's what makes you fat and skinny. It's what makes you happy or sad. It changes the lines in your face. It changes the shape of your body, how you move, and how you exercise, and how you walk are all conscious movements that are programmed into subconscious programs. None of that is innate. You're not born swimming. You have to learn to swim. You're not born walking. You have to learn to walk. You're not born thinking of calculus or music or able to paint. You have to learn how to do it. It's the muscle memory that you have to build. That environment that you build is what makes you what you are. You are not handed a life. You hand yourself a life. So let's get back on subject here. Photons from space, what effect do they have on the human transducer called the human body? They are part of the environment. They are part of the program writing protocol for your own cell walls. That means that the program that you put into your cells, when that cell dies, guess what happens to the program? It gets copied to the next cell. That's right. Not your genes. You don't have enough genes for all the proteins that make up your body. Each gene has to make a variety of proteins. It has a choice. It has a choice of thousands of different proteins that it can make. In some cases, hundreds, but in most cases, thousands. Like a menu. Like programming options. And which options are chosen and how that program runs and how that program is built depends on what? That's right. It depends on your consciousness. And it depends on the environment around you, including the photons from space. There are some photons from Earth as well, and we are synchronous with our planet. But I'm talking about the new region of space. As we near December 21st, 2012, there is hardly a scientist out there, physicist, cosmologist, even those that are experts in instrumental analysis. There's not one of them that will say that we are in the same neighborhood we were a year ago. We're not. We're being exposed to new types of radiation. And those new types of radiation are having an effect on the cellular program that makes up the human body. Now, what are the results of that? Seriously. No pun intended. Seriously. What are the effects? What could the effects be? Phone number, toll free, 888-228-4494. Locally, anywhere on the planet. If you're from Earth, you can call in. If you're not from Earth, you definitely need to call in. 530-776-5154. Let's talk about some of the effects. Indigos, some are called. Walk-ins, others. Star children. Beings that come to this earth that have a very strange light. Strange, not like haunting. Strange, like when they walk in the room, the color changes. The vibrational level in the room changes. It can increase in frequency. It can increase in importance, in vitality. In business, we call these people X-factor people. If you're in management, I'll teach you how to recognize them. If you think you are one, then listen closely. X-factor people in business are people that it does not matter where you place them in your business. That area improves. It improves in productivity. It improves in morale. It improves in punctuality. It improves in the feeling that it has when it runs. People are happy. Now, it's not necessarily anything that the X-factor person does. In other words, it's not necessarily that they go in there as a manager and they whip everything into shape. Far from it. Sometimes the X-factor person is a mere clerk, sometimes a mechanic, sometimes just a plain old line operator, a seamstress, or a person who puts screws in, or applies paint, or distributes parts. What happens when the X-factor person is put into that place? The place begins to change. The person doesn't say, "Gosh, I wish I worked somewhere other than this hellhole." No. What happens is the hole begins to change. We have a caller on line one. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Yes, sir. My name is Dan, and I'm in Florida.
Hi, Dan. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir. Yes, just a quick question. I actually meant to ask this last week when I called. I'm a huge fan of you. I got your books. Just wondering, I think I heard you mention on Coast to Coast AM, and I actually just tuned in, so I'm sorry if I'm not with it tonight. Just tuned in about 5 minutes ago. Yeah, I was listening to some of your programs that you did with George Norrie a while back. I think you did two or something, right?
Yeah, I think I've been on his program 4 times, but that's okay. We pretty much talk about the same thing.
Okay. I think I heard you mention that you were involved in the production and making of that movie, The Secret. Did you actually make that movie?
No, I didn't make the movie, The Secret. The Secret started out as a training program for real estate agents. What they wanted to do was teach real estate agents how to be more productive, how to sort of manifest their own future, so to speak. And it became pretty popular, and it got out there as kind of a doctrine. And then Rhonda Byrne penned a book, and it was a great marketing plan, phenomenal marketing plan. They gave away 100,000 books and got on Oprah and several other programs, and, of course, that just launched it. The movie The Secret is basically a marketing ploy. It doesn't really give you any tools, but it does inform you about a very amazing law called the Law of Attraction. And the results of our consciousness and how it affects the universe and how the universe can resonate to it. The tools are out there, and that's pretty much why I came on George Norrie's program, was to talk about the tools which we wrote in a book called Unlocking the Secret.
That's what it was. Okay, because I remember you were on Norrie, and you're like, what you said was, oh, yeah, you know, we did these first two books, and they were so negative that we had to do something positive, so we did Unlocking the Secret, is what you said. But I thought you said, so we did The Secret, the movie. So you just wrote the book, which is sort of like, which I have. I haven't read yet because it's like 400 pages. I'm working on the first one right now. But I guess Unlocking the Secret, the part three of that trilogy is, I guess, it's sort of based on the movie The Secret, or is it vice versa?
No, the two are only related in the sense that the movie The Secret is like chapter one, and it sort of whetted everybody's appetite, but everyone went home and cut out pictures of the magazine and bought magnets and stuck it on their refrigerator, and nothing happened. So what we felt so bad about that, because it's such a great concept, that and we found ourselves 2.5 volumes done with the 2012 end times. And I said to my co-author, EJ, you know, this is a pretty doom and gloom subject we're talking about. End times is not really, you know, something people want to wake up to. But what we need to do is do a part two of volume three, which we did, and it's called Unlocking the Secret. And what it does is it gives you a real-world toolbox and a scientific explanation of what the law of attraction is and how to make it function. How to put the inputs into the formula to make it work.
Okay, so hang on 1 second. I'm just trying to think if I'm actually missing one of the books. I got 3 of your books. The one entitled, I thought it was the third one, but you're saying the one called Unlocking the Secret, that's actually part 2 of volume 3. So what's part 1 of volume 3?
Part 1 is the end of the trilogy. It actually covers what's going to happen on December 21st, 2012. It covers the events that are going to happen, and as recorded by the Mayans, the Egyptians, the Toltecs, the Zapotecs, the Sumerians, all of these major races went way out of their way to make sure that we were left a message. And some say it was even us that left the message, and now here we are, 7 billion strong, with beings from all over the universe, and we're in this synchronistic time with our own planet, and the planet's getting ready to go through this change, sort of like birth or a transformation, an evolution, and we're involved with it. So we either are passively involved or we're actively involved, and that's why we felt compelled to write the second part to Volume 3, which is about the last 80 or 90 pages of Volume 3, to leave people with a positive message that we don't have to take it. We can make it whatever we want to make it.
I see what you're saying. So I guess part 1 and part 2 of Volume 3 are both contained in the same book.
That's right. That's right.
If you just okay, good, because I have that book.
Yeah, you got it all. And it's a good workbook. It has it's got a, let's see if I can remember right, I think 189 pictures in that book. So there's a lot of stuff in that book.
All right. Is there, do I have to get off the air or can I ask you more questions?
Oh, no, you can ask all the questions you want. Did we lose our caller? Oh, well, maybe he'll call back. He has more questions, I'm sure. He'll call right back. So what I want to make sure of is that you understand very clearly when we talk about this subject, there are new radiations that are coming into our planet, as is evidenced by this massive radio pulse that came to Earth yesterday. We're not sure what the effects are, but we do know that it arrived. And if you want to hear it, you can go to spaceweather.com and you can click on the recording and you can listen to the MP3 of that pulse as it arrived. Now, keep in mind, that pulse came into a radio antenna like a Yagi. A Yagi is those funny little parallel bars that you used to see on top of people's houses. Now everybody has cable, so you don't see them anymore, but those funny little parallel bars are called Yagi antennas. He picked up a radio pulse that came in from space and converted it, stripped off the audio, and plays it for us. So we know that these frequencies are coming in. By the way, that was not a government source. That was a private ham operator who had his frequency tuned correctly. I believe our guest is back. Dan, are you back with us?
Yes, sir, I am.
Okay, we have about 11 minutes left in this hour, but if your questions go longer than that, I'd be happy to hold you over to the second hour, and we'll just keep going.
All right, sounds good to me. Basically, I had a good one for you, and then my phone cut off for some reason, I'm not sure why. I was actually wondering what you thought about the author and lecturer named David Icke and his theories and things, because you're talking about frequencies and things like that. He gets heavily involved in that type of thing. But he also says some pretty controversial stuff about how he thinks that basically massive reptilians are ruling humans on planet Earth. I'm sure you've heard of that.
I have. I actually met David Icke a little over a year ago. We spoke on the same venue and had some off-stage time together. And I have to say, there is a sort of a dual genre out there in the area of awareness. One is what we call the doomsayers. These are the ones that say that there is a master race that controls us and we're being bombarded with controlling frequencies from the government and there's no freedom anymore and third world and, you know, one world government is going to take us all over and blah, blah, blah. And you know what? It gets good press. David's made a lot of money on that and a lot of speakers have made a lot of money on that. We don't do that here. So in that sense, I disagree with him, because I believe, and I have fairly good evidence, scientific evidence to back it up, that we are indeed sovereign beings, and all futures occur. And so therefore, if we choose to walk away from the path of Armageddon, we can do it. We don't have to go. And we are uncontrollable beings. That's what makes us so interesting. There is no Illuminati that can control the masses. It just can't be done. Now, I do know those that receive the little mailer in their mailbox or they see a commercial on TV, and it's just like a robot. You flip the switch on, and they begin marching, and they go pull whatever political handle is they're programmed to pull. But there are more and more of us out there that are waking up, and we realize that this is going on, and we don't move the way we're told to move. We are, as I said, sovereign beings choosing our own way and aware of what is going on. We're moving sort of like you know, there was a mathematician named Riemann, and he understood that there were multiple two-dimensional universes stacked one on top of another, and that if you just folded the paper, folded the two-dimensional universe, you could move through a slit, which he called Riemann's cut, and you could literally walk from one universe to another, or from one dimension to another, unaware that you had done so, except that the future was now different. So that's
It sounds like what you're referring to. I'm sure you've heard the term wormholes and stuff like that. They get a lot of press on the History Channel lately. I was watching this one show called The Universe, where they talk about that sort of thing and how they can convert wormholes possibly. And these are mainstream scientists. Like one example is Professor Michio Kaku. He talks about this type of stuff, especially on his own radio show. But they talk about, yes, how some of those wormholes could possibly be converted into some sort of time machine, taking you into the future and the past. And, yeah, I mean, there could be different branches here and there, different futures. The only problem I see, Dr. Ainu, is the whole thing with how, and I'm not really a conspiracy theorist, I try to look at the facts. And the only thing is, when you take a look at people's work like David Icke, and you compare it to some mainstream physics work, like, I got some books by, like I said a second ago, Professor Michio Kaku. There's not really a line with some of the stuff. Like, they both talk about different dimensions and how there could be possibly malevolent people there. At least, I don't know if they would be succeeding or not, but they would be making an attempt. And this is primarily what Icke says, David Icke. He says they would be making an attempt to control humanity. And he says some of those non-Earth-born, non-human intelligences are there. They do exist. They are real. It's a real force of negativity. But at the same time, Professor Kaku actually says, he doesn't say, well, hey, there's definitely, you know, people trying to do whatever to us in these dimensions, but they are there. They're definitely there. And to quote him from the History Channel, he says that right now there are dinosaurs in our living room, and we can't even tell. So...
Well, I have to agree with both of them on one level, but the thing about negative control and being able to move through dimensions or moving from one vibrational level to another is it's self-correcting. That is to say, if you're evil and you wish harm and dominion over another, you lessen your own frequency, to the point where you can no longer harmonize with the very portal that you're trying to go through to get to the next level. You also place yourself out of harmony with the light, with beings of light, or people that associate with light or seeking after light. And that's why you can't see one another. They want to be involved in this realm with us, but they cannot be, because they can't raise their vibrational level to the point where they become visible. Likewise, the phenomenon of orbs are ostensibly very high vibrational beings lowering themselves almost to the point of visibility. It actually takes some kind of a flash or some kind of radiation of some kind to make them visible just for a brief second. You can see them with the naked eye. If you take a strobe and just strobe it in a room, you can actually see the orbs with the naked eye, but we like to catch them on digital image and look at them. So, yes, there are beings just higher than us, and there are beings just lower than us, but neither one of them can exactly harmonize with us, to the detriment of both, I guess. But we, being in the middle and being multiple-dimensional beings, can perceive both. That's why David Icke says, look, they're real, they're there, they're dark, they want dominion, they want rulers, a rulership, and they're going to get it over those that will resonate with that vibration. But I don't, and you don't, and there are millions of others that do not and will not be part of that dominion. But there are also millions who will. And all you have to do is turn the cable news channels on to see those that do.
I see your point. Speaking, I guess, along the same lines, but this will be my final point, just my final question for you real quick. I just want to get your take on what you think, is possibly at the North Pole, because you said that you're still going and things like that, and I think that's incredibly interesting. And I'm just wondering, like, if, say, there is, like, some sort of civilization living inside the planet somehow. I mean, say the planet really is hollow, which, based on what you say and other people say, I think it very well could be. And I see at least some evidence to suggest that people are covering that fact up. I actually just watched your video. Well, it wasn't your video, but you were in the Holes in Heaven about HAARP. And all that stuff's kind of sketchy, and, you know, it seems like possibly even the people at HAARP could be detecting, like, stuff inside of the Earth. But I was just kind of thinking that the reason why they're so secretive about that project, or at least why they don't tell the public about everything they do, is because they know that there's stuff inside of the Earth, but they're just not really telling people. They don't feel like telling people. That's just my theory. But anyway, I was just wondering what you thought could be really honestly living inside there. And I know you say, like, other people can't rule over us too much. I mean, they sort of can, but ultimately we have our own power. But if there was, like, people living inside the Earth, like maybe a more advanced human civilization or even an extraterrestrial civilization, interterrestrial, whatever you want to call it, how do you think they behave, and what do you think their relationship would be to humanity?
Those are two really good questions. The one, let's just take the first one first. If there are races in the inner Earth, and I believe my statement on George Norrie's show was, if there is space between the crust and the core, there will be life there. It might be microbial, it might be more complex. To think that, you know, it is as complex as us, human or humanoid-like sentient beings living there, has captured the imagination of many, you know, for thousands of years. I can tell you that if it is there, it isn't widespread. It is a belief, but it isn't widespread knowledge. That being said, it's maybe about as much real estate as we have on the surface of the world, 5/7 of the world covered by water. And look at the diversity of races that we have on the surface. We have very benevolent, very kind, loving, merciful, charitable people, and we have those that can't wait to get the tools necessary to walk into the nearest Pizza Hut and blow themselves to smithereens. So we have the gamut of intelligence and caring on the surface of our planet. It would make sense that if there are races on the inner Earth, they have virtually the same gamut. Whether, and it's possible that David Icke and others, other channelers, are making contact with this very dark side, but there are others who are making contact with this very light side. That's why I've repeatedly said, in this scientific expedition where we're going to see if there is an opening, if there is some evidence to support the idea that the Earth might be hollow, that the very highest consciousness be maintained in that expeditionary force, so that whatever gate we open up is a light gate and not a dark gate.
I see sort of what you're saying, but that's getting into a realm that I don't really understand as far as, you know, going there and going through possibly a light or dark gate. I'm not really too advanced with my understanding of that stuff. I mean, the way I see it would be, you know, if it's there, it's there, kind of like my house. You know, it would be more in the physical, but I did hear you suggest on Norrie's program that it could be physical, but it could also sort of be like what you just referred to, sort of like a portal, where you would almost have to access some sort of field or portal or something to actually get there. And I guess you're saying that it might not entirely be physical, the inside, is that what you're saying?
Well, or the beings in it might not be what we consider, you know, bipedal, walking upright 3D people. They might be able to be just barely out of our visible light, where, you know, whatever photons strike their skin, bounce off, hit the rods and cones in our eyes, they're visible. It might take some kind of cooperative exchange of energy in order for us to even see them. Sort of like the shaman standing on the beach telling people to look at the ships out in the water, and no one could see them, until the shaman finally explained to them they needed to open their eyes and realize that there's something there that previously they could not accept, and he asked them to accept it, and they finally did, and they could see the ships. Now, that's an interesting story, but true. And I would really like to hold you over for minutes in the next hour, because I'd like to discuss this in a little further depth if you're open-minded to it.
Yes, I'm definitely open-minded to that. Thank you.
All right, no problem. Let me just make a couple of preparations here, because we're about 1 minute over, and I want to make sure if there are any affiliates out there that want to run commercials, that they can do so without losing any content like what we're talking about right now, because I think it's really neat stuff. So hang in there, and what we'll do is we'll take a very short break, and we'll come back, and we just take a little musical break so that people can, you know, get a glass of water or whatever, and people can run a commercial if they want to, and then we'll come right back, if that's okay with you.
All right, sir. That sounds fantastic, actually.
All right. Hang on 1 second here, and I will make – I'm looking for a piece of music, because you and I have been talking so long, I lost track of time. So, okay, here we go. What we'll do is we'll just play this and give people a little break, and we'll be back right after this. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio after this.
Roger.
Ice Fields. Coming to you live from Eastern Kentucky tonight, our AccuWindow forecast is about 66 degrees. No rain, finally. Although the area does need the rain. Hey, I wanted to tell you about the H2O Live concert. It's coming up very soon, June 19th through 21st. Where is it going to be? 26 different cities around the world. So one is close to you and very affordable to go to. Now, I want to tell you a little bit about this because it is the largest earth healing event in history. 26 cities, and the musicians that are playing at these 26 cities are retuning their instruments to 528 hertz, the frequency of love. What they're trying to do is heal the earth's water. That's right. And you can participate in it. There will be speakers there. I'll be speaking in Vancouver, B.C., William Henry, Los Angeles. We have a long list of musicians that are there. And what I want you to do is I want you to click on the H2O live concert link at X Squared Radio and go ahead and get registered, because these places are going to fill up quickly and we want you to be there to see this event. We know that what we think and what we do has an effect on the water of the Earth. Dr. Emoto has proven that with his photographs, and there are other scientists out there who are getting the same information from their experimental and clinical work. We want you to participate in this. It doesn't matter whether you live in Australia, the United States, Europe, Asia, South America. There is a city close to you that is having one of these concerts. Click on the H2O Live banner at X Squared Radio and get involved with that. Also, I think you own an inkjet printer. I own a couple of them. And even if you own a laser printer, those printer supplies can be very expensive. I sometimes run out unexpectedly and have to run down to the local Wally World and plunk down about $80 to replace the cartridges in the inkjet printer. You can almost buy a printer for what the cartridges cost anymore. Well, not anymore, because you can go to X Squared Radio and click on 123 Inkjets. Not only will you get the inkjet cartridges or toner cartridges at phenomenal low prices, I mean like $15 for a name brand inkjet cartridge, but you get free shipping, and every time you buy, you get a chance to win a free printer. Now, this is really cool. And the shipping's fast. I buy from them all the time. If you're stocking an office or you're just doing some home printing, that's the way to restock your stuff. 123 Inkjets at X Squared Radio. Now, don't go away, because we have Dan from Florida with us, and we'll be right back. So don't go away.
All right, sir.
Okay, welcome back to X Squared Radio, coming to you live from Eastern Kentucky. It is May 10th. Now, the next 2 weeks, you're going to be listening to archives, because I will be in China, and I'm not sure that they're going to give me an internet connection to run from China. But if they do, you can guarantee I'm going to be on the air bringing you something live from China. But the reason we're going there is we are visiting with contractors so that we can bring you the electric car as quickly as we can. I'm actually in Eastern Kentucky tomorrow and the next day and the next day. From now to Wednesday, I will be running time trials on the car we built in 1994. It's had a few upgrades, some paint, some tires. It runs just as good as it did. We built it 15 years ago, and it's ready to go into production. So we're talking about mass production of electric vehicles. So no more buying gasoline. How about that? And that's why we're here. All right, Dan from Florida, you're back on the line.
Now, yes, sir. We were just... yes, go ahead, sir.
Well, we were discussing the possible dimensionality of a doorway or a gateway between the surface world where we live and a possible inner world where it is, at least the legend says, that there might be races of either terrestrial beings or extraterrestrial beings or a combination of both residing on the inside of our planet. It does make sense that, you know, we are particularly, at least now, adapted for life on the surface of our world. But not many beings might be. They might not be able to handle ultraviolet radiation from the sun. They might not be able to handle the plethora of microbes and spores and pollens that blow around the surface of our world, and they might be more acclimated to an infrared environment on the inside of our planet and making occasional ventures out to see how things are going or to gather information or data or sightsee using their craft, which also reside just outside of visible range. You can often pick them up in broad daylight with infrared photography, but they won't show up with visible. So by what I mean by other dimensional is that it's possible that this gateway, this doorway, could be guarded by a mirage or by, you know, the way that we travel on our planet. We don't fly directly over this region of the planet. We don't allow satellite photography out about this region of the planet. And no one that I know of has ever sailed to this region because for the last 200,000 years it's been covered with ice. But thanks to global warming, it is possible to get there by sea. Now, that being said, now there's only one ship capable of making it to this spot and staying any length of time at all, and that is a Russian nuclear-powered icebreaker. There were two of them. Now there's one. One is in dry dock, will be there for at least a year. And the Russians are not allowing, I've tried it, not allowing any other nation ship to sail above the Siberian Islands, which is where we plan on going. So we have to work with the Russians. We have to work with a Russian charter company, and that has proven very tedious, very time-consuming, and very expensive. So that's where we are with respect to finding the opening.
Yes. Speaking of working with the Russians, I was just listening to a radio show just yesterday, and they were talking about how, and I think this is pretty much a fact because it was coming from another physicist like yourself, he was basically saying that they're going to, or at least NASA is going to retire like their main space vessel in 2010, and we actually don't have any plans to get a new space vessel until it was either 2014 or 2015, which means we would actually have to, at least in some part, kind of work with or rely on the Russians, like just to do some space operations and things like that. But as far as actually there being like a force field possibly around this area at the North Pole, you were referring to how it sounds kind of mystical, and I think sort of like a consciousness field that you have to go through. I think that all would sound really mystical to a lot of people. And I think a really important point to bring up as far as when talking about this stuff that people might not understand and people might not be able to relate to, it's just like a really general idea of science. I mean, science is basically a process of questioning. And we humans have science because we don't know everything. So when a lot of people take a look at your work and actually when you put it like that, they might get kind of turned off. But again, you know, we don't know everything and we don't really understand sometimes how to put it into perspective. So the current, mainstream status quo can actually understand it. Do you see what I'm kind of saying?
Yeah, I do. Let me put that into perspective. I was at the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory last year about this time. And that is not a mainstream observatory. It is a giant Michelson-Morley interferometer. And they have been tuning it and working on it with federal funds for quite a number of years. It's in Hanford, Washington, which is very close to the now defunct nuclear research site. And there's another one in Louisiana, and there's also another one in Australia. And they've been trying for a number of years to launch LISA, which is the Laser Interferometer Space Antenna. Basically, what these do is they're like a giant right angle, like a giant framing square of laser lights that are tuned to interfere with each other, split beam of very tightly controlled frequency laser, and then tuned to interfere with each other so that they get a null spot, a dark spot. And the theory is that if space-time ripples, like from a spinning black hole, then the pathway of the lasers will change, thus lengthening or shortening, and then the interference would be lessened and they would get a little pulse. Well, they tuned it and it worked with binary neutron stars, but we can already detect those with radio antennas. What we want to do is detect something radio antennas can't. We want to detect a black hole. So I was interested in it, and I was working in the area, finishing up a biodiesel plant up in Washington State last year. So I went up, and I visited Fred Robb, who is the managing physicist and also the mechanical engineer and the chemical engineer that are his main staffers. And I toured the facility and I listened to their lectures. And here's some mainstream science that mainstream science doesn't talk about too much. Dr. Robb said that they are detecting with this. Now, I can get down to about 10 to the minus 23rd inverse centimeters. And that's really a fraction of a proton. And they want to make it 10 times more sensitive than that with upgrades this year and next year. They are saying that they are detecting particles that are coming into this dimension from another dimension. That's a quote. And when I quizzed him out a little further personally after his presentation, he said they are now scientifically, empirically aware that not only are there other dimensions, but that there's energy and particles coming into our dimension from that dimension. Now, you know, a year ago, that would have been considered very Indiana Jones. And when we talk about that in mainstream science, we begin to change the foundation of what is called peer review. So, and if you look at the papers that I published and listen to the, as you have just recently done, the public interviews that I've done on this subject, I'm very careful to say that I don't believe the Earth is hollow. When people ask me that, I say, I don't know. That's why we formed the hypothesis. We have designed the experiments. We have collected the instruments and the experts to run them to try to gather enough information to prove or disprove a hypothesis that planets form as hollow balls. If we make a breakthrough there, it has a multidimensional effect on what we consider mainstream science, geology, cosmology, oceanography, you name it. We now have identified an opening between dimensions, and one of them is inside our own planet. And if we get something
else, that's the whole thing. That's the whole thing, Brooks. We can't really talk about belief systems when it comes to facts. I mean, it's definitely not a current mainstream fact that the Earth is hollow right now. But one of the main points you actually brought up, you know, I think you just did a second ago as well, is that a lot of people talk and hypothesize about, maybe the Earth's hollow, maybe it's not. You got some people putting out publications, some books I have making fun of people that think it could be hollow. But one of the things you pointed out is, well, nobody's really been there, and I think that's the big point to bring up. How can you say it's not hollow at this particular location where there's an opening when you haven't even been there? That's why you're going there, and that's the whole point. But
you could also say, how can you say the Earth is not hollow when you have other evidence, satellite photography, seismological data, we have marine life data, we have the seismological data just recently analyzed by Washington University that declared in a very open, not scientific journal only, but very open paper that said there's another ocean the size of the Atlantic Ocean underneath the crust of the Atlantic Ocean. We heard it. So how can you say that Earth is hollow, is not hollow, when you have that evidence?
Yeah, that's very interesting. I actually haven't seen that publication, and I actually haven't seen all the facts that would, at least possibly suggest that it could be hollow, besides the one thing you brought up on Coast to Coast, which is when you said that the satellites don't really go directly over the North Pole or something like that. And even
release images. They do.
Right, well, I thought you said on the, on your website, you actually had a short little video that actually said the polar satellites kind of swing around it a certain way where they don't really go exactly over the location you're talking about. Is that correct or is that inaccurate?
No, what it says is that in February of 2006, the federal government, actually an international coalition of governments, passed the Data Denial Act, which denies photographs above the 60th parallel to be available to the public. Now, they do it for security reasons, I guess. They don't want them programmed into cruise missiles that would come over the polar caps and attack us unawares. But I can tell you that it's quite frustrating for lots of people that try to do research on this and just cannot find the imagery. It's just not there.
Yeah, that's definitely a very interesting thing. You know, they could potentially put in, and I'm not really a huge conspiracy theorist or anything like that. I definitely think there are criminals inside of our government. There are people like Jason Burmes and Alex Jones who actually document on their website, Infowars.com, basically that there are definitely criminals in our government that are doing some pretty crazy stuff. But I don't know if there's a massive conspiracy to control all this stuff. But at the same time, I do know that they can easily hide stuff, whether it's criminal or just secretive or whatever you want to call it, under the guise of national security, whatever it is. It can be pretty much just about anything, and they can just put that title on it, and you're not allowed to take a look at it. And I think that could easily be the case with what you're talking about, how they block access to the images from the polar satellites.
Well, one has to ask the question, why? Why would you not want the general public to know what the Arctic Circle looks like from space?
And yeah, I agree. You know, and I think, didn't I hear a little while back, I'm not sure if this is correct, that I think they could have identified possible openings on other planets as well. Is that true?
Yes, absolutely.
In the polar regions.
The presentation that I make publicly, excuse me, had to push my cough button, Saturn, Venus, Mercury, and Jupiter all have similar IR signatures. And by the way, this is a hexagonal shape, which is pretty amazing. It's very well documented on Saturn. And Mars also has an IR signature at the North and South Poles. And we're talking about significant infrared signatures. These aren't just a few degrees warmer. These are many, many, many degrees warmer, suggesting that either the crust is very thin there or there's some kind of infrared ion stream coming out of the poles, similar to what would happen in a quasar or any other body that has counter-rotating inner and, or say, an inner core and an outer crust counter-rotating against one another. You're going to get an ion flow. We call it flux lines. They're actually continuous lines of force along which ions have a propensity to move.
I see your point. Now, you were asking a second ago the question of why would they actually not want people to know and have pictures of those regions and things like that. You know, just kind of a theory, a hypothesis that I was thinking of. I'm sure it's something along the lines of what you're thinking of as well, but I just want to put it out there anyway. You know, if the Earth itself is hollow and there is some sort of opening at the polar region and there's possibly life inside of it that we're not allowed to be, you know, we're not allowed to understand what's there and who's there and stuff like that, obviously that indicates if our planet is hollow that other planets could be hollow as well, including Mars and other planets in our solar system. Therefore, the other planets in our solar system could be inhabited with people inside of the planets, not necessarily on the outside. For whatever reason, that just happens to be the biggest secret of all time on our planet. So I think that could at least be one of the possible answers to your question. But I also had another question for you just real quick. You said on Nori's program, Coast to Coast AM, a while back, I think it was to the South Pole, but it could have been to the North Pole as well. I forget. But I believe it was to Antarctica. And you were talking about how some of your associates were actually going down to the pole and they went missing. Now, did you guys ever find those people, or what happened with those people?
Yes, we did. His name was Jason, and we just call him Jason X because he doesn't want us to use his last name. They made their way to New Zealand, and that's where we lost contact with them for several weeks. And that was while I was on Nori's program. As it turned out, they were trying to get transportation from New Zealand to Antarctica because there were a lot of ships going back and forth, and they could not get passage. And it wasn't that they were Americans, it's just that they weren't what was called, they called it affiliated. They weren't affiliated with a National Science Foundation grant or program through an affiliated university, and so they were denied access. And although they tried for several weeks to get down there, they finally gave up and returned home. And that's where we caught up with Jason and we got the full story. It was a little strange because they had the money to go. They just could not get clearance to go because they weren't involved with an NSF program. Now, some people need to know something a little bit about federal grant programs. If you file what's called a patent waiver, which is where you retain the ownership of the knowledge either that you bring to the table or that you discover during the project that's funded by federal dollars, that can be a little tricky to negotiate. You actually, you know, have to have some history behind you doing business with that, doing commerce with that. Normally what happens is anything that's funded with federal dollars is federal property. And as you stated earlier, if it has anything to do with national security or with energy or anything like that that could be valuable to the federal government, they become what's called a shareholder. But they become a preferred shareholder with overriding voting rights. And that can prevent you from going into business with it or from sharing it with anyone else. And that's where not only the conspiracies come from, but it has very real, very real foundations, because that is actually the law. And if you don't believe me, you can look up 60 CFR 600 and read it for yourself.
Yeah, and you know, I totally agree with what you're saying there, and that definitely is the law. I've heard about that from other sources. But, you know, again, it's just my opinion that they can pretty much take just about anything, whether it's the subject of where UFOs come from, their reality, and really anything, you know, with some of the stuff you're talking about as well, data denial acts. They can really just hide all that stuff under national security, in my personal opinion. I think that's what they do. And if you actually have some criminals, I'm not saying everybody in the government's a criminal, but if you have key criminals in our government that do criminal behavior all the time, they're not such fantastic people, then you have an issue, because they can sit there and do all kinds of stuff, possibly referring back to what David Icke talks about in his book. He talks about how in some of these underground areas, they do all kinds of crazy stuff, really extreme, crazy scientific experiments on people and all that stuff, which we don't have any hardcore evidence for. But if, say they were advancing the sciences in some lone island somewhere or something like that, some of these criminals inside of our government and the governments of other countries, they could really hide all that stuff just under national security, which they have laws for, which is what you're talking about, and things like that. But, you know, back to the Hollow Earth thing, I just wanted to ask you a real good question. You know, I was actually, I know they refer sometimes, some cultures and stuff refer to the Hollow Earth as the spirit world and things like that. And actually, I had just two questions. My first question is not really exactly having to do with how they call it the spirit world, but I was watching this one documentary film. I think it was Blue Planet. And basically on that documentary film, they go all the way down to the bottom of the ocean for the first time and videotape it for the first time ever, is what they claimed in the video. And you can see all these wild animals and crazy creatures down there that have bioluminescence, which that just means, I know you know, but just anybody listening, bioluminescence is just when they have these things on their skin that it's almost like a light bulb attached to their skin. Therefore, they can glow underwater all the way at the bottom of the ocean, so they can see and find prey and also avoid prey and things like that. They have bioluminescence. That's just some of the creatures. They have all kinds of crazy creatures down there. But there was also this really weird spot all the way down at the bottom that was almost like a perfect circle surrounded by, I believe it was, mussels. And what some of the people in the program actually said was that perfect circle all the way down at the bottom of the ocean, which they actually refer to as a lake. Okay, so they're calling something a lake, but it's, wait a second, I'm already underwater at the bottom of the ocean. How's there a lake, you know? So they were calling it a lake because they say it's made out of a different density, but it was like a perfect circle, and they said they tried to penetrate that perfect circle surrounded by, which looked like mussels. And they said their craft actually bounced off of that circle, and they were not able to penetrate it, almost like it was a force field. But they said it was just made out of a different density. Now, first question, have you ever seen what I'm talking about on videotape, and do you think that could be like some sort of opening into the inside of the Earth?
Well, those are good questions. I haven't seen video, but I do know that at the bottom of the ocean, not only is it very cold, but it's very dense, and there are pools of methane. Methane is a lot heavier than water, especially when it's in liquid form. And it's one of the problems that we have with global warming. As the ocean temperatures rise, it allows this methane to go into gaseous state and bubble to the surface. Now, if you want to see global warming runaway and you want to see greenhouse gases really get out of control, watch a couple of a million cubic yards of methane leak into our atmosphere. So it's quite possible that this was a liquid pool of methane at the bottom, and their craft, neutrally buoyant, floating around in the water, neither sinking nor rising, but using little fans, as it were, to propel itself forward and backward, couldn't push itself through the methane because the density was so high that it was so buoyant, it would be like trying to push a balloon underneath the bathwater. It just won't go. So that's what they're talking about, a difference in density. Their craft just did not have enough fan power, and they couldn't change the buoyancy of their craft sufficient so that it could go into that pool. That's probably what it was.
Yes, I believe that's what they said. I believe they actually did quote say that it was methane. But the term they used, it was just kind of strange. They said their craft bounced off of that stuff. So the way it looked was just very strange. It could be nothing. You know, I'm kind of, you know, 50-50.
Well,
I don't know. I think it could
be. You have a little camera sub that might weigh 80 pounds. And underwater, it probably weighs 3 pounds. And it develops maybe a half of a mile an hour in velocity. And it just doesn't have enough momentum or weight to get into that dense pool. So bouncing is a pretty good acronym.
See, yes. About global warming, you were talking about that a little bit. I had a question about that. As far as global warming goes, I was watching that HARP documentary, I think it was just a couple of days ago, Holes in Heaven, that you were actually featured in just a couple of times. And
11 years ago.
They were talking about... Yeah, that was. I realized that it was kind of an old documentary, but it's
still
a
top seller, though. There's still a bunch of them sold every year. I'm amazed.
Yeah, no, it was pretty good. It was one of the best documentaries I've seen in a while, even though it was kind of outdated. But they were talking about how, and this was, you know, pretty much in the own words of the people at HARP, which I didn't even realize they had a public relations person that kind of came forward and told people about it. I didn't realize that. But he was one of the people, one of the PR people for HARP, was actually basically saying that they shoot things into the atmosphere. I think it was it the ionosphere they shoot stuff into?
That's correct.
One of the layers of the
atmospheric heater.
Yeah, and they basically shoot the beams up into a layer of the atmosphere, which heats it up. Now, if they're heating up the atmosphere with, you know, artificially, which they admit right there on videotape in that documentary, which is basically an artificial way of doing to the Earth what the sun does already, do you think that is at least in part a cause of what we call global warming? Or is it really just all this CO2 that we put out and we should all just be taxed? Yeah.
Well, that's a good question. Let me address the first one first. HARP, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project, owned by the Navy, powered by natural gas on the North Slope of Alaska, was invented by Bernard Eastland. 7 patents filed on it. One of them is to manipulate the ionosphere to create an artificial Marconi effect. Marconi discovered that he could bounce AM signals off of the ionosphere and cross the ocean with a radio signal. Now, for the national defense system, we cannot rely upon the somewhat unpredictable morphology of the ionosphere to communicate with our submarines. So Eastland invented a way, using a phased array set of antennas up on the North Slope, to reshape the ionosphere into a parabolic bowl, and then broadcast ELF waves, these are extremely low frequency waves, in code directly to submarines around the planet. Not only could they get a very targeted signal, but they could do it with a very low power level, so it was almost impossible, it was impossible, to be picked up by enemies or by eavesdroppers. However, the frequencies that they were using to reshape the ionosphere gave me great alarm, and that's why I was featured in that documentary. I was the one that made the presentation on a phenomenon called the solar tap. And this is where the right frequency is chosen, it's focused in just the right way, and it creates a sort of ground wire between the ionosphere and Earth, so that you get a lightning bolt of biblical proportions. We're talking not a bolt the size of your fist arcing through the sky like we normally see in the Midwest or the South, but a bolt several kilometers in diameter. And when it strikes the Earth, it continues to strike until the potential between the ionosphere and the Earth gets to such a low point that there's no longer enough current to, or voltage to make that jump. And that could take several minutes up to a half an hour. By the time that's done, not only is there no ozone left in the atmosphere, but there's a tremendous amount of particulate matter that's been blown into the stratosphere by being changed into pure energy from this bolt striking the planet. Hardly a toy to be messing with. Now, that being said, HARP, the documentary section, was just recently reshot in December for the History Channel. I built an experimental cloud chamber in Santa Monica for the History Channel. I built a miniature version of HARP inside of it, and I created a cloud inside this chamber, and I fired up the HARP, and we watched as the cloud was pushed from one side of that chamber to the other in a matter of seconds on film, and we did it repeatedly. So when that documentary comes out, it's going to really open some eyes as to what that weapon system can actually do.
Okay, so you're saying you just did that, because I actually tried to find video footage of that on YouTube, because I heard you make reference to that before with the move of the cloud. That sounded incredibly interesting to me, so I tried to find video footage, couldn't find it. So you're saying that's new and it's not out yet?
That's right. It's new, it's not out yet. I can't tell you the name of the series by contract, but History Channel did film it, and it should be out very shortly. You don't want to miss it. Of course, once it comes out, they're going to let me have a copy of it, and it was quite amazing to watch.
Sounds pretty amazing. I'm definitely going to watch that. I mean, that sounds really cool. But as far as, again, just HARP actually artificially creating the global warming phenomenon, do you think it's doing that? Like, you know, they said in their own words in that Holes in Heaven documentary that they can basically heat up the ionosphere. So do you think that's causing global warming?
I don't think it's causing global warming, because when you heat the ionosphere, it's such a low density, it doesn't really conduct, there's no heat transfer. And the global warming gases that we're talking about reside far under the ionosphere in the lower levels of the atmosphere, because the ions that we're talking about are like O3 and you know, very, very sparsely populated up there, although they do respond. Now, the thing about it is, when you push the ionosphere out into space 40 or 50 kilometers, the stratosphere has to move to fill in the hole. And when that happens, you actually reroute the jet stream. In 1996, Secretary of State Cohen had to sign a treaty agreeing not to use HARP as a weapon, a weather weapon, that we would not manipulate the weather against another country.
Yeah, I mean, in theory, that sounds fantastic, but, you know, are they going to actually practice what they preach as far as that goes, and have they used it already without anybody's knowledge?
Treaties are meant to be broken.
Actually, yeah, yes, they were, but... yeah, that all sounds extremely interesting. But as far as, you know, HARP goes, you were talking about how it can, you know, shoot that electricity down at the ground and stuff and really mess stuff up. So, you know, they say on record that it can't be used as a weapon, and you were just talking about how it could be used as a weather weapon. But
it was designed
with
as
the
a
electricity
weapon.
That you were... What's that?
It was designed as a weapon system. I didn't tell you the other six patents with that. They're even more devastating than that.
they say that it's not a weapon system. They've said that repeatedly. I'm going to take your word for it on that, but that's what they tell the public. You know, this was not a weapon. You know, it's just doing, you know, in research and things like that. But if it can do what you're talking about with the electricity, I think you made the reference to, what was it, 4 Mount St. Helens eruptions, what was it, per minute, per second, something like
that? Yeah, right, 4 Mount St. Helens eruptions per second.
But that was a worst-case scenario. Even half of that would do extreme damage, and that sounds to me like a weapon of mass destruction. But
remember I told you that they can bounce ELF waves off of it. They can also bounce super low frequency and ultra low frequency waves on it, and can actually, and have used it as mind entrainment weaponry. They used it during the Gulf War to literally drive the bunker occupants crazy. After 30 days, they came out of those bunkers like whipped kittens. They couldn't do anything because they hadn't slept in a month, because they'd been kept awake by harp signals.
Wow. Okay, now was that actually on the record, and did they actually openly admit that, or what?
They actually used subsonic warfare against them, and we use it in Iraq right now. I have already spoken to several soldiers who have come back. They have mobile units. They mount on the back of vehicles. They park them in position. They back up behind the radiators. They turn it on. And what happens to the bowels of those in front of it is they are liquefied. And within 3 hours, troops can march in and just literally clean up the enemy, because they're so weak they can't even stand up. All with subsonics.
Yeah, that's pretty intense. You know, I was watching in that video, I think it was one of the electromagnetic specialists, I believe it was, and he was talking about how, yes, they can use those ELF waves for mind control. You're basically confirming that, and you're saying they definitely have done that in the past, and they're doing it right now.
Using the
ELF waves to control the human body, possibly even the brain, you're saying as well.
Yes, it's called non-lethal weaponry, and there are many spokesmen out there. Dr. Nick Begich is not the least of them, that say that this is it's not honorable, but it is a violation of the privacy of the human mind. And if they can use it for that in warfare, they can use it in domestic purposes as well.
Wow, yeah, I was actually listening to Coast to Coast a while back. There was a guy named Roger Tulse. He was on the program, and he was talking about how, yes, they actually signed a law to do that, I believe, as far as actually using the non-lethal weaponry on their own population. I believe it was the U.S. government that actually signed a law to do that, and he made reference to the law. I looked it up. It was correct. But it did seem there were some, I don't want to say precautions, but there were some limitations as far as how they can use those non-lethal weapons on people. But I think the question is, do they abide by those rules and regulations or not? I want to say they probably don't. And programs like the CIA and those really higher up organizations that are, in my opinion, at this point are just totally out of control. I would say they can pretty much do whatever they want with that stuff. And who's going to detect them? Most people probably don't even know about that stuff. You know, I didn't even know that they actually already definitely use that stuff in Iraq right now, the certain ways that you were talking about and things.
Well, cover story tonight on Drudge Report. Quote, hundreds of thousands of lives were saved by using these non-lethal methods of coercion.
And what did they actually do with those waves to save those lives, I guess, would be the question. Which are you making reference to?
Yeah, well, that's part of the conspiracy, I guess. But I can tell you that the weapon systems do exist, and I call them weapon systems because we're using them against the free will and choice of other human beings. It can be done. It is being done. It is real technology, and it is being used right now. It is in the U.S. arsenal. The scary thing is, we're not the only ones with it, and we're not the only ones using it.
Wow. Yeah, I was watching a documentary a while back. It was about MK Ultra. I'm sure you've heard about that mind control program that was supposedly abandoned by the U.S. The U.S. Congress basically abandoned the MK Ultra program. Something along those lines. I read a little bit about it. Also watched a documentary about it. And in this particular documentary, they were saying how a while back, several years ago, somebody was actually beaming some of those beams at people. I think it was in the Pentagon. Have you heard about that one? And it actually got a lot of people sick. Did you hear about that?
I don't remember if it was the Pentagon or it was an embassy, but they were irradiating that building.
Yeah, the embassy. You're absolutely right. It was the embassy. I apologize. It was not the Pentagon, I don't think. I think they did say one of the U.S. embassies or something like that, and they got a bunch of people sick.
Yeah.
And that was several years ago. I mean, how advanced is this technology today, and, you know, who are they using it on? You know, as far as the HARP thing goes, I mean, they could just be really using that stuff on a massive scale all over the world to do whatever they really want to do.
Then again, you know, we don't talk about the conspiracies of what they could be doing with it. I'm just telling you the technology is real. It works. It functions. And there are even other applications besides the two that we've mentioned here tonight. I don't want to talk about them because it just gives them energy. But I can tell you it is completely possible and demonstrable to move weather using HARP.
All right. Very interesting. Have you heard of a type 1 civil... What's that, sir?
No, go ahead. Go ahead. I interrupted you.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, as far as moving weather, controlling weather, things like that, I was listening to one physicist make reference to what he calls a type 1 civilization. A type 1 civilization is just one of three, which he makes reference to, which is actually a branch off of a civilization classification system created by a scientist over in Russia. And the type 1 civilization would basically be just a planetary civilization where they control the weather, they can control earthquakes, there would be cities on the water. And politically, I just asked this particular scientist just the other day on his radio program how it would happen politically, and he didn't really know. But as far as physically, you know, they would have, like I said, cities on the water, they would have, they would be able to control earthquakes somehow. They could possibly identify pressure points on the Earth's inside of the Earth at different crust points and things like that where there's friction. They could almost like acupuncture. They can go in and relieve some of that stress and, I guess, relieve the earthquake as a consequence. But, you know, these people make these references to a type 1 civilization, which is basically the same thing as the New World Order, just with a different name on it. But they say that we're not there already, and I'm not understanding why we're not there already when we have programs like HARP that are totally secret and classified that can basically the same.
I can tell you that this rating system was not a political one. I believe it was Carl Sagan.
No, it's not.
0, 1, 2, 3, and 4. We're a class zero society. That is to say,
yeah.
we're a step above hunter-gatherers. We do grow our own crops, we domesticate animals, things like that, but we're still basically tribal. In fact, not basically, we are tribal. What a type 1 civilization is one that has overcome its tribal nature and has learned to live in harmony with the planet. They get their energy from the planet, they give the planet what it needs to have its stability, and that would imply that we have basically a single world. You could call it one world government, but I would prefer to call it a world without tribal rule. We live as earthlings, not as English and Africans and, you know, whatever. We live as a single planet with different nationalities on it. We're not there yet. We could be there. Because there's more than enough and to spare as far as energy and the ability to support the 7 billion people that are on this planet right now. But it's going to take some responsibility. That means no more burning petroleum, no more burning coal for energy. There are other sources of energy, and we need to be doing it, regardless of whether it causes a complete economic collapse for a few weeks or not. We need to make the switch. because our planet is going to die if we don't.
Well, I'm totally for saving the Earth if there's some sort of mega catastrophe and things like that. But I think the question to ask, and you know, I understand that the Type 1 classification system is not a political system. It's they say it's from physics. That's what they say. The one guy that was talking about that I listen to all the time. But I think one of the most important questions to ask, and I would be for a, I guess what you would call like a planetary civilization, if it's done openly, but people like Alex Jones at Infowars.com and Jason Burmis, they actually identify with facts, it's not a theory, how these people are doing some of this stuff kind of secretly. They're manipulating events to sort of get into a one world government, but that's another story. What I wanted to say real quick is, as far as this status goes, this change, you know, whether, you know, if it causes an economic collapse to make the switch, you know, I don't know what my opinion is on that. I don't think that would be a good thing. I would say a smoother transition would be much healthier for all of us. But, I mean, as far as the switch goes, I think a good question to ask is, does the U.S. or other nations actually lose sovereignty? And will the U.S. actually lose its constitution and Bill of Rights in the process of switching from a sovereign nation, which physicists call a Type Zero civilization, to a Type One civilization? When we're in that Type One status, are we the U.S. anymore with our Bill of Rights and our constitution? Or are we something else that whoever decides?
That's a good question. What I would like to believe is that the Constitution will then proliferate. That is to say, it will not only be our Constitution, at least the good parts of it, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration that we have inalienable rights, that we have some direct relationship with God, or that we even are gods. I think that's going to proliferate. And the idea that it's about time to separate religion from state, that's probably a good thing, too. That's why we are what we are, and our Constitution is the oldest one on the planet. Now, that being said, does it become now a constitution of interdependence, and there's no longer America and Russia and England and, you know, Brazil? That remains to be seen. But it's clear that our Constitution works. It's outlasted every other constitution on the planet. And we're productive. And by and large, 98% of our society spontaneously obeys the law. That's better than in any other country on the planet. We only have to build prisons and have police for 2% of our society. And those are just people that just won't obey the law. They won't respect other people's privacy. They persist in committing larceny and harm and damage and rape and whatever against other people, and they need to be segregated from our society. If we could get to that 2% level with every other nation on the planet, we would be in great shape. So in that sense, I'm all for doing away with patriotism and proliferating earthlingism, if that's what you want to call it. What I do have a problem with is that there's ostensibly a rumor out there that there's a small number of human beings that want to be the rulers of the one world government. And that, my friend, is a self-correcting desire. If you desire darkness and oppression over others, you will only last a millisecond. Those that desire benevolence and charity and mercy and education and health for all, those are the ones that are going to survive.
Listen, I hear you 100%. I'm still a little bit on the fence. I'm in full knowledge of what's actually happened as a result of looking at some of the information on Infowars.com and comparing it to other branches of information as well, tons of different branches of information. I see what's going on, and I'm a little on the fence as far as, well, am I for a one-world government or a Type 1 civilization or not? And there's definitely some pros and cons with the whole issue. You know, as far as losing the patriotism, losing the sovereignty, you know, I don't know if that's such a fantastic idea. I think one of the main things to understand is back in, what was it, 1776, 77, something like that, when we actually founded the country, when we actually developed the Constitution, are we really that much more advanced physically? Are our brains, you know, more evolved than it was back then? I don't think we are that much more evolved back then. I still think we are savages, like you say. We're tribal people. And I don't think we're really that much better than we were back then. Therefore, the people that wrote the Constitution way back then, I think they are just as good as we are now. And I think having the Constitution to protect us is actually a fantastic idea. And if we don't have stuff like that, I think we could be in serious trouble. Hopefully not. But
I'm just saying we need to protect the planet and not a single nation.
I agree with that. But I think we can. What's a idea of doing that while still holding up your sovereignty?
You mean national sovereignty?
Well, okay. How do we protect the planet while still having the U.S. intact as a sovereign nation with the Constitution and Bill of Rights? How do we do that?
Well, I think you just answered your own question. I don't think it can be done. I don't think it can be done. It's just not a way to have a United States of America with all that we have here and have everyone else have nothing. It's just not in the cards. I'll let you know more when I get back from China in a couple of weeks. Dan, I got to move on. End of the second hour. Call back, though. You're a great guest and like to have you on again.
All right, sir. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you so much. Earth Explorers, we're going to take a really quick break, not very long, and we'll be back. We've got Ramon on the line. Don't go away, Ramon. We'll be right back after this. It's been a very fast night, so try to keep up with us. We're going to have a lot of fun. We'll be back with more of X Squared Radio and Ramon from New York. And keep your minds open. The past is coming to us. Welcome back, Earth Explorers. third and final hour of X Squared Radio. If you're not getting all 3 hours, please let us know. We'll get with that affiliate and we'll fix it. We'll make sure that you get all 3 hours where you are, because it's important. We talk about very important things. In the last hour, we talked about a lot of political things without really being political. And if you agree or disagree, sooner or later, if you have a chance to get out in space, I recommend that you do it. If you have trouble doing that, call me and I'll fix it. We'll get you out there so that you can see and look back and realize that Earth is far too small and fragile a basket in which to place all of our eggs. We have other things we need to be doing with each other besides warring with one another. Far too small of a place to be living that way. If it means proliferating our constitution, then so be it. Don't forget, June 19th through the 21st, the H2O Live concert, the biggest Earth healing event in history. If you don't know about it, tell a friend to get to xsquaredradio.com and click on the H2O Live concert banner. You'll learn all about it and how you can become part of it. I'm talking tickets as cheap as $15, people. Come on. You pay more than that to go to a movie. Why not be a part of history? H2O Live concert. Click on the banner. We'll be right back. Do not go away. We've got more exciting stuff coming to you. All right, Earth Explorers, this is where the past meets the future. This is where we discuss those thoughts, those ideas with experts from all over the globe to try to become a better race, to try to rejoin the galactic community. Speaking of the galactic community, we have Ramon from New York. Ramon, welcome to the program.
How are you doing, Dr. Agnes? And happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there.
Very well said. Exactly right.
I'm going to change the subject a little bit, but I feel like all subjects combine into one. But to kind of pick up where we left off last week, when you had, what was his name again? Kramer?
Michael Cremo. Oh, yeah.
Cremo, sorry. I was reading a couple books, looking at different things, and I came upon a part where there were ancient Hawaiians talk about when they first got to the island, there were these white people with red hair. And it's so funny how that kind of continues in the West Coast, you know, in China. I believe the Indians talk about them. I believe that these were the ancient Atlanteans and probably the ancient people from Mu and the other continent. Some of that was part of Mu, the one southern of India that supposedly sank down. I can never pronounce it the way they pronounce it. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
Yeah, that's Mu. You're right, the Lemurians. Well, now, the Lemurians and Atlanteans were two different races. And, by the way, those very tall, very muscular, red-haired people also existed in Europe. They came up against the Romans in battle many times, and they used to starch their hair and build it up really big, and they wore metal bands on their neck and on their arms to intimidate the enemy, and they were rather large, 6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot tall, and coming up against a 5 foot five Roman, it could be quite intimidating. They also wore breastplates and armor, which were actually introduced into warfare, and they were a particularly warlike people, it seems. And I believe
that way all over the world.
It seems in my research that they were Atlantean, that the red-haired, white-skinned were Atlantean, and that's also where the Irish came from. And my lineage comes from that as well. I've got my lineage back to the year 695 from from Scotland to Ireland, and then I lost it in Ireland. I've got to get back there and find out where the roots came from. So every once in a while you hear my accent come through, but I really try hard not to let it through. Anyway, so tell me where your research led you.
I'm starting to believe, I believe that these were the ancients, but has anybody done tests on those mummies that were found in Washington State, I believe in Mammoth, what's that called, Mammoth Caves? I believe there was some found
caves in Kentucky. In Washington State, I'm trying to think where those mummies were found. I think it was they were on Indian land, so it would have to be pretty close to Spokane, I think.
And in South America, all over the world, and test them up against modern-day redheads and see if there's any connections or any lineage.
You know, that's a really good point. We, of course, the Human Genome Project is kind of an ongoing thing, but they've made great strides. Lots of good funding there. My brother's team at Johns Hopkins had a sizable amount of funding, and I'm sure other universities did as well. But as far as going back and trying to find links between modern DNA and ancient DNA, the only one that I really know of was the test between Neanderthal man and modern man. No genetic link. We are not descendants of Neanderthal man. How about that?
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. But it almost seems like these redheaded mummies are, you talk to the average person about them and they just laugh like, oh yeah, that's BS. You know, these white people been roam all over the world.
Oh no, absolutely true. South Carolina, North Carolina, red-haired, blue-eyed Indians, Washington State, South America, Europe.
Yeah, there's stories about them all over the world, so how could
everybody
be lying at the same time?
Well, yeah, that's a really good question, because I asked Michael Cremo that question. I said, look, you know, you found these skeletons that were dug up, and they weren't dug up by miners. They were discovered by miners, but then they call in world-class geologists. I mean, these guys are so well-published that they are the encyclopedia by which other geologists measure themselves. And they state that this skeleton is definitely in a strata undisturbed that is 55 million years old. And then you have the archaeologists, the anthropologists say, oh, that just can't be, because we know man has only been on the earth for 20,000 years. And the geologist is trying to say, hello, wake up, I just told you 55 million years, rewrite your book.
And no, they won't. It's a little bit frustrating, but I just want to make that statement. But as far as I was looking up last night the H2O concert, and it has me so excited. And what's even more exciting is that I started with just a trip going to James Gilliland's ranch, and now instead of just going there, I'm going to first start out in San Francisco, and then from there go to Hawaii, go to a couple islands, and then then go to James Gilliland. And the reason why I'm bringing that up is because I will be in San Francisco during the H2O. And
awesome.
I'm going to see if I can catch a ride down to L.A.
That should be easy to do. Yeah, awesome. That sounds like a wonderful itinerary for a year. Your life is going to change, my friend. You're going to have an ascension experience.
Yeah, and then to end it all off, end up going with you to the North Pole.
Well, that won't end it all. That's just the beginning. When we open that doorway, everything is going to change.
But as far as this H2O, because as far as Art Bell doing those experiments when he was on air with the rain and stuff, that kind of spooked him out, because he would ask for rain to quench a fire, and he would get, you know, a flood, and it kind of spooked him out, and he stopped doing them. But as far as us doing this, what changes do you see that can happen? Because I remember hearing about the experiments they did in Washington, D.C. in order to reduce crime, and they saw a significant drop to it. And, of course, a lot of people say that's a coincidence, you know, those things don't happen. But like me and you, we don't believe in coincidence.
Well,
what changes do you see?
You know, that being said, you're talking to a statistician. So one-time events are just one-time events. But if you get two or three or five or ten, now you've got what we call statistically significant. That is to say, you can scatter plot one against the other. And if the plot is correct, then you can draw a one-to-one relationship between the two. Now you've got something that you can apply and you can work and add more energy to. And you know, it is amazing. With respect to water, I was looking at, you know, Dr. Emoto's work. My gosh, you see a one-to-one relationship between human intention and the crystallinity of water? That's important.
Yeah, yeah. And we're, what, 90% water?
Well, as we get older, we're less and less. I mean, as babies, we're probably 90%. But as, you know, we hit our teen years, we're probably close to the high 80s, and then middle-aged, low 80s, high 70s. We don't drink nearly enough water. And did you remember the story that was told, and it's true, about the germ warfare designers who were drinking nothing but water and all went to the hospital poisoned, and they couldn't find the source of the poison? And what it was is the water was picking up on the intention of the people who were planning mass genocide, and the water killed them?
The water turned on them. And so I just kind of see, like, maybe I'm being too optimistic, but I kind of see such a great future after this day. And the other question was, in your studies of putting together the three books, did you find anything across, maybe a prophecy or anything like that, speaking of maybe people doing something like this?
Well, you know, not exactly. What we found was that it appeared that multiple ancient civilizations, highly organized, highly intelligent as far as mathematics and literature and map-making and traveling and astronomical study, decided to leave a message for our day. They specifically spent a significant amount of their gross national product to make sure we got the message. And I'm wondering, is it that they cared about us enough to do that? Or was it actually us in a pre-reincarnated state leaving a message for ourselves so that when we reached a point where Earth was getting ready to go through this evolutionary change, that we would remember what it was we were supposed to be concentrating on? As to it being optimistic that people could awaken, yes. We did find there were numerous prophets and numerous writers, both in language and in pictographs, or that is to say hieroglyphs, that recorded that if we were to wake up and stop fighting each other over land and water and destroying each other over ideologies, but coming together and working together, that we could actually go through this portal with Earth. Yes, there was going to be a division. Some called it the rapture, but I think that was a complete distortion of what was really going to happen. That was a much latter day kind of interpretation. We're talking very ancient framework for the Earth moving to a higher dimension and taking with her a significant amount of its population. There's lots of evidence for that. Lots of evidence.
That what probably the Bible was talking about, the whole... I'm not a Christian or anything, but of course I grew up in a Christian household, but is that what the Bible was talking about, the 144,000?
Well, the 144,000 are actually mentioned twice. One is a set of 144,000 that are taken up into the sky, and then they return with Christ, ostensibly 12,000 from each tribe of Israel, and they actually help him reign on the earth. Now, I'm not sure if that's an instructional reign or if it is more of a ministerial reign. And then there's another 144,000, which actually have seals placed in their forehead, and they too become saviors on Mount Zion. Now, some have tried to say, well, these are one and the same, but they're not. They're treated separately. They're treated separately. Now, the idea is 144,000 a real number, or does it just mean 12 times 12,000? Is it just a large number? 12 times 12 in Hebrew is, you know, a large number. So to say 144 is a large number. To say 144,000 is also just representative of a large number. It is not an exact number. There are not going to be 144,000 and only 144,000 enlightened beings. We speak about in our book, when we come back from the year 2015, in Volume 3, to lay this down, is we're really looking for 64 enlightened souls. And we call these, in modern day, games sphere cleared. What this means is that they are completely sovereign beings and they're able to teach others. So the 64 turns into 128, and you can see this binary progression. It just flows out. And what happens is you end up with a crescendo of light, a critical mass, as it were. And what happens is darkness loses its grip over the human race.
It, really, briefly, the 144,000, is it possible that that might be a frequency and not necessarily amount of people?
Good point.
That just came into my head. I didn't even think about it clearly. It just came into my head.
That's 2 meters. 144, well, it isn't. That's in the AM band. 144 megahertz is the 2 meter band. By the way, that happens to be the frequency that HARP operates in, the 2 meter band.
Isn't that a coincidence?
Come on, Ramon. Coincidence? Oh, it's synergy. Synergy. The forces of darkness are trying to work in the same frequencies as the forces of light.
Speaking briefly, do you remember, have you ever had the experience where you either have an out-of-body experience, it's happened to me in either form, or lucid dreaming, where you, I forget what they call them in ancient Europe, but it's like you have these really dark beings that visit you, and sometimes they like sit on your chest, and some people feel paralyzed, or they feel like they can't breathe, or they get out of their body in an out-of-body experience, but then they can't move. Have you ever had one of those experiences?
I haven't, but I know people who have actually been, had gone out of body and not been able to get out of the room. They slam into the wall. They can't get out of the room. They're locked in, and they hear things like, you know, this isn't about you, or they hear, you know, things like not so fast, or one step at a time, or things like that. Now, as, you know, in response to is it a dark being or a light being, I don't know. I have heard energy classified as dark energy or dark matter, and I've already said on this program that may be quite arrogant of us, that it may actually be very light matter, and we just can't detect it, so we call it dark matter.
Yeah. But as far as speaking from that perspective, in my own personal experience, because I can only speak from my personal experience, it's, with me, it's a very negative energy. And it's almost like some kind of psychic vampires. They feed, there's different kinds. Some of them from the experience I have in that other world, is they feed off either your fear. Sometimes they fear off your anger. They feed off your anger, or they feed off your lust. But once you realize that what's going on, and you realize that either A, you're having a lucid dream, or B, that you're having an out-of-body experience, and you focus on love and you focus on the heart, and kind of bringing this light, they're so powerless to it. But if you are so scared out of your mind, they're so strong and you can't move. But once you realize what's going on, and you're like, okay, let me calm down and just do some breathing and focus on the heart, they lose grip, like you were saying, so easily. And the reason why I'm bringing that up, it's if that's true in that sense, and unfortunately I can't prove this scientifically, I would think that would be true as well in a worldwide and even probably in a universal.
Well, it is true. Well, we had a guest on this program about 3 years ago. His name was Samson, and I'm trying to remember his last name, and I just can't remember it right now. He did say that there was a race of beings just out of our reach who do feed upon our fear. They feed upon our state of confusion, and when we're kicked a little bit off balance, and it doesn't take much for a 3D being to be thrown off balance. I mean, how many of you out there, by a show of hands, ever dreamed you could fly? Ah, see, I told you, just about everybody. Obviously, we can't fly. We're locked to the planet. But we do dream that we can do that. We can just lift off the ground and go flying among the trees. And some people get way up in the air, and some people only get a few feet in the air. But that is an altered experience that the physical body tries to do and can only do in its dreams. So it doesn't take much to kick us off balance. Now, that being said, once you become a sovereign being, once you learn that you have total control in these situations, you do not have to be held paralyzed. You can choose simply to stand up and walk, so to speak. You can choose to dispel the darkness and say, you have no power over me, leave me alone, and it will go away. It has no choice but to respond and obey your command.
It's almost like they go hungry. They can't feed off you anymore. So it's like walking into a refrigerator is empty.
Yep, they're going to go for easy prey. So don't become prey to them.
I just gotta say, I'm so excited. Any recommendations on Big Island? Because I know James talks a lot about the kahunas.
Yeah, the kahunas are kind of like Hawaiian shaman. They do have a great knowledge of Hawaiian history. I was speaking to a kahuna. I was there in April of 2007. Yeah, April of 2007. And I asked them, because I didn't see dolphins in their ancient art, only in their new stuff. And he told me that the dolphins were a recent addition to the planet. That's why they're not in their ancient art. I thought that was pretty cool. But a kahuna is like a Hawaiian shaman.
I never heard that before.
Now, whales have been around, but not dolphins.
It's just when I think of dolphins, because I remember watching a program on sperm whales, and they were talking how the Atlantic sperm whales and the Pacific sperm whales have different accents. But I remember hearing in school that we're the only ones with languages. So, that's a contradiction. How is it that...
Oh, they have languages.
Atlantic sperm whale has one accent, and you have the other accent. It's like, okay, I'm from New York, and I have one accent, and somebody from L.A. has a different accent. We're speaking a language, so... And I've heard other scientists say that
for us, it's easy to understand one another. A little accent doesn't change anything for us. But you bring somebody from Japan over here who's learned English from someone from England, and they can't understand the Southern dialect. They can't make a word of it out.
I've actually experienced that one. Yeah, it's the same like in Spanish. Somebody who learns Spanish from Spain won't understand the dialect where my parents are from, which is the Dominican Republic. They won't have a clue what we're saying. They might catch one word if they're lucky.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's even here in Queens, I've heard plenty of times where people are like, okay, I don't understand what that Mexican guy is saying. And then I guess because I grew up around so many different ethnicities that I'm able to pick up what they're saying, and I know a lot of the slangs and dialects, and I understand. But going back to the sperm whale, these animals are such amazing. It's almost like I would like to take one of them on as a teacher, because their brains are so big, and they have to, from what I remember hearing, is that they have to, they consciously breathe.
That's correct. They have no medulla. It's all conscious breathing to them.
But what happens when we consciously breathe, when you sit there in a meditative state and consciously breathe, weird things start to happen. So
are
animals always in the state of mind?
Well, are you asking me, do whales meditate? And I can answer it if you're asking that question.
Sure, why not?
I was interviewing Joan Ocean, and she is the one that started the tradition of swimming with the whales, swimming with the dolphins. And by the way, that practice has been abused so much since she started it so many years ago that now it's illegal to swim with the whales because there's been so much abuse. Joan Ocean is a purist. So she's swimming with the whales off the coast of Cuba. And now, she doesn't use scuba gear. She just naturally breathes. She holds her breath. She can swim to amazing depths. I mean, I can swim to about 40 feet, and she can go below where I go. She's floating along, conserving her air, you know, just using her mask and her snorkel and her fins. And there are whales below her. And they turn tail up, that is to say their noses are facing the center of the earth, and they swim so that they just maintain their depth. They're not going any deeper, they're not floating back to the surface. And then they start this kind of chant going. And she said the chant is so loud, and it covers so many frequencies, all the way down to subsonic, all the way up to almost ultrasonic in the nasal cavities that they possess. She said the vibrations were going through her body because she's immersed in the water. And she said it appeared to her that these whales were in a state of meditation and that they were singing to the earth.
Wow. That kind of reminds me of a story of I've heard that story before, actually. But it reminds me of when they put that record out in the 70s of It's Just Song Whales, and how some people would listen to it and just break down to some of the whale songs. And I was just thinking, during the H2O concert, wouldn't that just be great if someone can actually drop a microphone and kind of tune that music also into our music? Like, now you're, you know, cross species, not just, because I'm sure they want the same thing we want. You know, they know what's going on. I'm 100% certain they know what's happening. We just treat them like they're fools.
I'm going to pass that suggestion along to Leonard Horowitz. Leonard Horowitz is the organizer of the H2O concert. I'm going to pass that suggestion along to him because many of the venues, by design, are on the ocean or very near the ocean. And I'm going to see if they can't do just that very thing. That's a great suggestion, Ramon.
Yeah. I just think that would intensify, because not only do you... It would be the first time a cross species works together on any music.
Wow, that's exciting. That gives me goosebumps. I like it. I like it a lot. Pass it along.
Because I remember listening to the records, and it does give you goosebumps. And I don't know exactly what they're singing about, but it's emotionally, I can almost understand where they're coming from. It's like some of them are this, like, very sad, longing kind of, not, perhaps it's the wrong word, but it's like this sadness with some of them, and some of them, it feels different. And some of you just can't put any words on it, but you feel there's just not a word in our language for it.
You know, I really resonate with that. My first and only time in Hawaii, I couldn't pass up an opportunity to swim with the dolphins, so I went out with Angelica Whitecliffe and Michael Sala, and she runs a very well-disciplined and very compliant dolphin swim with the spinner dolphins on the north shore of Hawaii. So we're heading out, two boats, about 25 people on each boat. We're going maybe 35 miles an hour. And I asked her, are we going to see any whales? And she said, no. And I had this conversation the day before with another woman, too. She said, no, they've all gone north. This was in April. And I said, man, I just really thought we would see some whales because, you know, this North Pole thing, I just kind of thought that maybe they knew I was here and maybe they support the expedition and, you know, they might spread the word. And no sooner had I said that, I mean, literally less than 2 or 3 minutes, we saw whale spouts. Well, both boats, under law, have to go to idle and wait for the whales to pass. Now, the whales are about, I'm going to say, 400 yards from us. And the two boats are about 200 yards apart. Those whales did turn. They turned straight toward our boat. And there were eight of them, and they swam straight for our boat, and then they passed right in front of the boat. I was up on the bow, kind of leaning over, taking video of them approaching. And they passed right by the front of the boat, and they almost rolled on their side to look up to see us hanging over the side of this boat. That's how close they came to us. And then they swam away. And I'm telling you, Ramon, there was not a dry eye on the boat. Nobody said a word, but it was so powerful. Really amazing.
They're just such wonderful beings.
There weren't supposed to be any whales there.
What's, on which island?
It was the Big Island, Hawaii.
On Big Island? Okay,
right.
So I'm gonna try to do a reservation for that. That would just be wonderful. But I'm gonna get off and keep listening online.
I will
definitely see you on July 2nd.
Yep, we'll be there. James Gilliland's Ranch in Trout Lake, Washington, July 2nd. I'm telling you, people, if you have never seen a UFO, that's the place to go. I've seen one, my first one when I went there in 2006, and it's happened every year since then. That place is a hot spot, let me tell you.
Are they really UFOs? Because it sounds like James already identified them.
Very good. Well, I've taken photographs of them in broad daylight, and so have people standing right next to me. Two different cameras.
James has actually been on their ship.
What's that?
I said James has actually been on the ship. That's why I'm saying that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there is some kind of sanctuary there, I can tell you, from personal experience.
Oh, if anybody's listening out there that's an inventor and is good with small gadgets, please invent something that can allow us to talk to whales and dolphins.
Yeah, a universal translator, please.
Yeah, like from Star Trek. All right, so I'll keep listening.
All right, my friend. As always, thanks for coming on the program. You really make it special.
And keep us updated with if he actually does do that.
Yeah, I will. I will.
Okay.
Absolutely. All right, Earth Explorers, this is the third hour of X Squared Radio, and I'm telling you, if you don't get all 3 hours, please get a hold of us, and we'll make sure that we get a hold of that affiliate and get them to let you get all 3 hours. We are coming to you live off the BBS Radio Network and also through the Conscious Media Network. And this is the kind of program we do things a little bit differently here. We try to combine the past and the future together in a way that that helps you understand your relationship in time. In fact, we try to make you aware of the fact that you are a multidimensional being having a mortal experience. And what we really want you to do is to remember the future. Now, that sounds like a play on words, but I assure you it is not. I don't mean to hold a special place for the future. I don't mean to put it on a mantle. I don't mean to think about it or concentrate on it. I mean all futures happen, and they happen simultaneously, and have happened for eons and eons of time. Time. The arrow of mathematics through the physics of the universe. If you could just remember the future and remember who you are and why you came here and what it is you're here to do, because this is a very, very special time. We have a caller on line one. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Hi, my name is Eclia. I'm calling from Fort Lauderdale.
Wonderful. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I heard you make a comment on the Coast to Coast show that you had visited the Potala Palace in Tibet. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, that's right.
Yes. I was wondering, I know you walked through it and you said that you had gone down to the basement or something, and you looked around at the artifacts and such. Do you think there was a dragon race that lived below the palace in the caverns of the mountain that gave spiritual knowledge to the Tibetan monks?
You know, I actually went there with the idea that I was looking for that dragon root ray. My friend Sean David Morton had told me to go there and look for it.
Mm-hmm.
So my guide is pretty good, and my American guide, whose name is Gary, there were 11 of us that went, and it was, the whole trip was kind of auspicious, as a matter of fact. When we went to the Potala, you know, the Chinese government runs everything, and there's chains on panic bars on doors where you just can't go through.
Mm-hmm.
And every time that they've been there, they've asked to go through these two particular doors, and they've always been turned down. So they didn't even bother to ask this time, and I said, well, listen, Gary, I came a long way, and so did everybody else. Why don't you go ask, and I'll hold my intention that they're going to let us in.
Mm-hmm.
They opened the doors, and they let 11 of us in and two pilgrims, which happened to be in the right place at the right time. So I said, now, I want you guys to really be aware of what's called the dragon root ray. That's what we're looking for. So we walked down a short hallway. It was maybe 30 or 40 feet long, and then there was a set of stairs. But the stairs were really odd because it only went one step, then two, then, you know, three, then five, then not. I made it about to the third landing, and I said, guys, this is a Fibonacci spiral. So when we got to the bottom, I stepped off on what normal people would call a swastika, but, of course, it was much, much older than that. And in the middle of that was a big piece of turquoise. And when my eyes adjusted to the light, I saw this huge golden, not golden, it was made out of gold, 10,000 pounds of gold, and, well, no, 4,300 pounds of gold and over 10,000 gems is what my guide said.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the burial place for lamas, for Panchen lamas and for Dalai lamas.
Right, right.
So the peculiar thing about it is it looked like a Tesla coil. That was the peculiar thing. And I'm wondering if the Tesla coil and the stupa and this root ray have the same function.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Are you familiar with Alex Collier at all?
Yes, I am familiar with Alex. I've tried to get him on the program. I have not been successful in doing that, but I have heard of him.
Well, apparently he's had a lifetime of conversations with bees from Andromeda, and they've told him that supposedly the founders of all humanoid existence in the Milky Way galaxy are called the Ptahl. And when I heard that, and I know about the Ptahla Palace, I thought, I wonder if there's some connection there. I wonder if maybe there was an extraterrestrial race who was trying to help us make our connection with the founders, the Ptahl.
That is very interesting. That sound, Ptahl and Ptah, and other names associated with that have, you know, I was going to say homonyms around the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And it is interesting that seed, that sound, and the purpose of that name is in the root, because if you look at Pakal, Pakal was the ancient king of the Maya, whose tomb was discovered in, I think it was 1958, was uncovered by 1961. That was pretty powerful stuff, that he was a giant. His son had six fingers and six toes, and he talked about the gateway to the stars and what he called the ladder to heaven. And mm-hmm. he introduced the serpent bar and the idea of multiple dimensions to the Maya people.
That's very interesting. Well, Alex says that the Andromedans have told him that the Ptahl were high-level beings that lived on the 11th density, that actually some of them have reincarnated into the present Earth-time existence in an effort to raise the consciousness and help the evolution of the whole planet. And they did that knowing that they were going quite a ways down from where they were, but feeling confident that they would be able to work their way back up. And I'm just wondering if maybe some of the people on the planet now are maybe extensions of that original founder race, and that they're the teachers and the explorers like yourself and some of the other people that are having such great influence on our consciousness evolution.
Well, that's why I say it's important to remember the future. If you could just bring forward or bring backward all those experiences that you have and pay attention to that yearning you have inside to help others see what you see and know what you know and realize what peace there is in that. I mean real peace, an absolute absence of conflict. I think it has the potential to save the planet.
Yeah, we have to reach up and be more than what we are. And we have to consciously evolve our own genetic makeup.
We are evolving our genetic makeup. I can absolutely testify to that. Scientifically, on a molecular, biological level, we are altering our own genetic makeup, our own protein makeup of our body. Our genes might be the same, but our genes have a choice of what proteins to make. And that is based on the programming in the cell walls, which is based on, or at least a function of, our environment, which includes our consciousness.
Exactly. Okay, that's about all the questions I have. It's been great talking to you, and I love your show, and I like what you're doing. You're a great example.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad you came on the program tonight. Please come back again.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Thank you. Good night. So, exploring is not just about jumping in a titanium can and heading out into space. Exploring is not just a method of sitting on a pillow with nice music playing and a candle burning and drifting off in an out-of-body experience. We can explore here with each other. We can look for the good in each other and help it to grow. And it's funny, as you turn up the light, it is amazing to see the darkness recede. If you learn anything about being a part of X Squared Radio, tell a friend and get them to come on Sunday night between 8 and 11 Eastern Time, 5 and 8 Pacific Time. Join the program, and if you're not going to join live, listen to the archives and share that with someone. Because the idea is we have very, very little time. 2 or 3 years, things are going to get crazy. They're kind of stable right now. We're hanging on by our fingernails. We have a chance, a very good chance, to save this planet. And we can do it if we work together and if we love together. And that's what I'm asking you to do. It's May 10th, 2009. In a little over 3 years, we'll be at 2012. Cataclysmic? Wonderful? Difficult to tell. I think the decision is ours. Choose and grow, my friends. And that's what my message is for tonight. I just wish the best for all of you, and I will be concentrating on that. Not that I can have any influence on your life whatsoever. It is your creation and yours alone. If you are living in misery, consider your creation, my friends, because you are the creator of your own reality. The optimist and the pessimist live in the same world, in the same neighborhood, on the same street, and even go to the same place of employment. And yet the optimist believes we live in the best of all possible worlds, and the pessimist fears that's true. Be with us. 2 weeks we're going to be in China, so the next 2 weeks will be archives, but please come back and listen, and we will be here for you. Email me when you get a chance, bagnew@x2-radio.com. We're coming to you live from the BBS Radio Network and the Conscious Media Network. So, be good, and we'll see you in 3 weeks. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio, saying peace, Earth Explorers.